The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
As a good friend of mine likes to say, lawyers don't make cases, facts make cases. And so fact-finding, certainly in disputes, whether it's civil litigation, arbitration, international arbitration, white-collar criminal defense, the finding of facts that is going to be able to poke holes in your adversary's theory of the case and support your legal theory is crucial. And so whether that's getting material to impeach the adversary's witnesses or it's finding evidence that supports your theory of the case, it is really integral to the prosecution or the defense of any dispute.
Hi, and welcome to The Hearing. My name is Tanae Frazier, and I am your host for today. Today's guest is Dan Nardello. He's the founder of Nardello & Co. It is a private investigation firm, a premier private investigation firm in the United States and the UK. We wanted to bring an episode about private investigations to our audience because we wanted to highlight the changing role of private investigations in the legal community. And not only just the changing role of private investigations, but also its importance in the fact-finding process. I also wanted to share how others can mitigate the risks that are involved in hiring these types of firms and make certain that they're doing their due diligence, because we want to make certain that whatever firm that we're hiring for this task, that they are actually carrying out that task legally and ethically. My favorite insight from the episode is how Dan and his firm have been recognized by many entities. They've been given many awards and accolades. They've been recognized as a Chamber Band 1 investigator firm. They've worked on very notable cases. However, his highest honor is the recognition that he gets from his true loyal clients, as he calls them. And those are the clients that return to him and engage him for more and more of his work and his services over and over again.
The Hearing.
Thanks for joining me today, Dan.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Dan, your firm has been recognized as the best in business and the gold standard for private investigations. Just recently, you've been named as the 2024 Global Investigations Reviews Investigations Consultancy of the Year. That was just for last year. But before we get started talking about some of your accolades, can you give me a little bit of information about your legal background and how you started your journey to founding Nardello?
Happy to. So I started after I graduated from NYU Law School. I started at a New York law firm, Patterson Belknap Webb & Tyler. And I was there for 4 years. And during the 4 years I was there, I worked on libel and defamation cases and some white-collar criminal representations. And I met my mentor, Mike Mukasey, who later on went to become the chief judge in the Southern District of New York, and then the attorney general under George W. Bush. And he encouraged me to go to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office in 1987. I was there for 7 years, finishing my time there in the Securities and Commodities Fraud Unit. And when I was looking to leave the U.S. Attorney's Office, and this doesn't really speak to my legal background, I fell in love with a woman in Rome and decided that I wanted to live and work in Rome, Italy. And I had studied Italian. While I was a prosecutor, I worked on some cases with Italian magistrates. And so I started to look for a job in Rome, and I met folks who had an investigative firm in the U.S. who were looking to open up in Europe. Rationally, they were looking to open up in London as opposed to Italy, but I made them an offer they couldn't refuse, and so that's how I got into the business, complete serendipity.
Okay. So what was the offer that you made that they couldn't refuse?
To work extremely cheaply. and if I knew then what I know now, I would never have done it.
Okay.
But it turned out to be a success. I made a success at the Rome office. I ultimately left Rome and opened up an office for that firm in London. That was in 2000. And in 2001, I had become a partner in the firm and we sold it to a publicly held company. I worked there from 2001 to 2003. And in 2003, I set up on my own in London.
Nice. Now, what initially was, I know that you said that you met a woman in Rome and you fell in love, but did you have any other motivation for starting the firm outside of falling in love and I need to get a job, make money?
In Rome. Yeah. Well, by the time I moved to London, I was very much involved in the business. I had learned the techniques that one uses in the world of private investigations. And when I decided to set up on my own, it was because I wanted autonomy. And I also wanted to focus on a particular type of investigation. And what I really wanted to focus on was complex, often cross-border work, as opposed to more commoditized types of investigative work. So that was really my motivation when I set up my own firm, and that was in 2000 in London in 2003, so 22 years ago.
How did you hone those private investigation skills so you could actually work in that area?
Well, I had a background as an investigator when I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. So I had that background. I had the legal training. I ran investigations, complex investigations when I was a federal prosecutor. So that gave me some framework. Although what you can do as a federal prosecutor with, the FBI, the DEA, the IRS, and a subpoena pad are quite different than, the constraints that you have when you're doing this privately. But over the, I guess it was 8 or 9 years I was with the other firm, I learned the art of doing things as a private investigator. And in fact, when I started the work, I was surprised that people would talk to me without, you know, the FBI or without a subpoena pad or without compulsory process. But you'd be surprised how many people will talk to you if you just ask in the right way. By the time I set up on my own, I had had 8 or 9 years experience doing this in the private sector.
So Dan, there was a special area that you wanted to focus on that was opposed to what others were focusing on in this investigation field. Tell me more about that.
Well, I wanted to focus the work that my firm did on more complex, often cross-border investigative work. Like, for instance, we're often retained by law firms when there's a significant FCPA investigation. Another example is we do asset tracing worldwide. And that was the sort of work that I wanted to focus on. I thought was the most interesting. Parenthetically, it also happens to be more remunerative than sort of more commoditized work like, you know, background investigation, pre-employment background investigations, and simple investigative tasks. And so that was the goal I had when I set up the firm, to focus on that kind of work.
And those are some of the areas that you're practicing in now as the firm, because I know that you're involved in complex litigation and special investigations, and also some activist defense. But those are your practice areas now, correct?
Yeah. So what I like to say, to sort of sum up what we do, it's any sort of fact finding related to a legal enforcement regulatory theory. And we also do a lot of work in when there's a crisis in crisis management situations, which usually implicate one of those issues, either regulatory enforcement or legal. So that's the work that we do, and we do it globally. I like to think we do it quite well.
So when it comes to the special investigations, what does that process look like?
Well, at a high level, what we do is really quite simple. In the first instance, we almost always do a deep dive into public records, what we call open sources, which is anything out in the public domain. And this includes classical litigation information, real property holdings, media, but we're also increasingly in this environment looking at social media, and anything that is out in the public domain. So that's the first level typically, or the first tranche or the first phase of any investigation. And then what we do typically is go out and talk to people. And the people that we talk to fall really into two categories. The first is what we call confidential sources. And those are folks that we have an existing relationship with and that we can talk to with a sort of an assurance of discretion that it won't get back to the subject or subjects of the investigation. And then the next sort of level of folks that we go and talk to are third parties that we don't know, but we can approach and speak to. So examples of that, it might be former employees, litigation adversaries of the people that we're looking at. Sometimes, and we've done this particularly in criminal cases, former spouses can be good sources of information. Mm-hmm. Former PAs or EAs. I like to say if anyone ever spoke to my assistant, that would be the end of me. They can be very good sources of information, mm-hmm. particularly when you're looking to build up information to impeach somebody's credibility.
When you're carrying out these special investigations, how are you ensuring that the investigation is very thorough?
That's a great question, and it's one that we spend a lot of time on. So first and foremost, frankly, is having the right people do it. And the folks that we have here really are experts in their fields. So for instance, if we're doing an investigation in about Russia, we have people who have lived and worked in Russia, who are fluent in Russia, understand the ecology of the Russian system, have access to the appropriate databases, know how to make distinctions between what's real and what isn't. Mm-hmm. And that applies to, the work that we do in the United States. So if we're doing white-collar criminal defense work, supporting a defense lawyer in a white-collar case, we'll probably staff it with folks like me who are former federal prosecutors. Mm-hmm. And we have now, I think, seven of them. In addition to folks who were formerly with the FBI or the U.S. Postal Service or with the DEA. So it starts with the people. And the other bit is we have a whole team that assures quality. And so there's a process for brainstorming on cases to make sure that we're being as creative as we can be. Mm-hmm. There's a process for making sure that what we communicate back to the client is clear and concise and is usable. So that's the way we do it. We start with people who are pros in private investigative work, who relish being thorough and diligent. And then we have various processes internally to make sure that we're being as creative as possible, and that the work that we're doing is done to the highest level. And I should add that everything we're doing is completely ethical and legal. There is a fair amount in this business of coloring outside the lines, and we pride ourselves in coloring within the lines and making sure that we're not causing any problems for our clients.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because when it comes to ethics, what are some ways, if you were to give advice to another attorney, or what are some things that they need to be aware of to make certain that they are coloring inside the lines and don't get into that gray area or that outside area?
No, that's a good question. The in the U.S., all of the ethical rules that apply to attorneys throughout the various states make it clear that the acts of investigators that attorneys hired are imputed to the lawyer. And so what that means is lawyers can't look away. They can't say, go find whatever you want. We're not going to ask any questions. Mm-hmm. But there's a duty of supervision on the lawyer. But the most important way of assuring that people act ethically is the culture that you have internally. So we train people on what the do's and don'ts are. We make sure that when we're using, for instance, subcontractors, if we have a case in Azerbaijan, we may use someone is a subcontractor in Baku. But we vet those people. We make sure they understand what the ethical obligations, our ethical obligations are. We sign them up to confidentiality agreements. So there's a whole process around making sure that we're acting and anybody that we engage is acting ethically. I teach a course that I formulated for what is called in the States continuing legal education, CLE credit, ethics credit, on legal issues in legal and ethical issues in retaining private investigators.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the do's and don'ts and where the lines are quite familiar to me and to my colleagues.
Now, tell me something. You have firms in the UK and in the US. So tell me some of the differences between practicing, you know, in the cultural approach to practicing in the area of financial crime and investigation in those two areas.
Well, one immediate difference is privacy rules, which in the UK, there's something called the GDPR, which regulates the collection of personal information and data. And those privacy rules are also throughout Europe. So one of the big issues that we have to be attuned to when we're working in the UK, and we have a counsel, our chief legal officer is a former white collar partner at Skadden, and we have a whole group of folks who advise us on this. But you need to be attuned to local privacy regulations, and they're much stricter. As a whole, they're much stricter in the UK than in the US. So that's one thing. The practice also differs a little bit because, for instance, in the US, we do a lot of white collar litigation support.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is reflects a cultural difference in the legal systems. The US is much more an enforcement based system. We're more litigious generally, both in civil litigation, but also in criminal litigation.
Hmm.
And so we do much less of the white-collar defense work in the UK because there's not as much need, among other things, giving the relatively low success rate of criminal prosecutions in the UK.
Hmm.
So my old office in the Southern District, I would think, I haven't looked recently, but their conviction rate is 98-99%, something like that, maybe mm-hmm. even higher. The Serious Fraud Office, which prosecutes financial crimes in the UK, I would dare to say is a far lower conviction rate.
Really?
So there's less of an impetus to bring in investigators where you can sit back and rely on the government not proving its case.
Mm.
So there are certain cultural differences in the jurisprudence, and as I said before, certainly in attention to the privacy and data regulation schemes.
Would you speculate why the prosecution rate is lower there as opposed to here?
I think it's reflective of a cultural cultural difference in approach. We're much more of an enforcement related culture. I mean, mm-hmm. we also incarcerate more people than anywhere else. I also think, and this doesn't explain all of it, but the way the system is constructed here, and I'm talking really for the moment about the federal system, you get young people, well-trained young people from good schools and often after clerkships going to federal prosecutors' offices and then coming out and going into the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
And so the U.S. attorney's offices typically attract very bright, ambitious people who want to make the mark.
Mm.
It's not quite the same in the U.K.,
right.
Which is not to say there aren't very good lawyers in the Crown Prosecution Service, but it's different. And there's not that back and forth between, a prosecutorial role and a role in the private sector. So the talent group, I think you get in the U.S. and federal prosecutors' offices is somewhat different than you get in the U.K. You get young people who are, you know, young in their careers, want to make a mark and are looking to prosecute people. That's what they get up and think about all day.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been in this field for a very long time. But if someone else were coming into this area and they had to navigate the UK versus the US and their laws, how would they get acclimated to that, to those differences?
Well, I think if they were with us, and we have folks joining us all the time, you know, it's a question of doing the work and education. We spend a lot of time training our people. So folks in the US work often, we work very collaboratively, not only with our UK office, but our offices in Dubai and Hong Kong and Singapore, and, you know, LA works with London and with Singapore. And we have offices in LA and Washington, mm-hmm. DC, in addition to New York. It really, at least in our firm, it's a question of training, doing the work with, certainly initially with close supervision. So you're learning the ropes and learning what to expect in the various jurisdictions. And then, as I mentioned before, we have an in-house legal department that keeps us alive to the rules and regulations that apply in all of the jurisdictions in which we work.
Yes.
And that's important. It's certainly important to make sure that, as I said before, we color within the lines.
The Hearing.
You're an attorney with a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. With superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence, be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, I dare to ask this question, but when you started the firm in 2003, what are some of the key differences in the way that you carry out your investigations in that time as opposed to this time? What are some of those key differences?
Well, one is we have many more people. I started with me and one other person. I think we're up to about 110 full-time employees.
Goodness.
And then we have, I don't know, 300 or 400 folks that we rely on all over the world, mm-hmm. for their specialist expertise. So that's one big difference. We have many more resources. The other, I think, is over the last certainly 22 years, the importance of our cyber team and the digital investigations. Is that much more important? So in any particular case that we're in, there is typically or almost always a digital investigations component, whether it's analyzing data on a laptop or imaging computers in Africa for examination in Paris. Mm-hmm. So the role of our cyber and digital investigations group is absolutely integral and essential to what we do. Mm-hmm. I think there's increased sophistication with the databases that we use. And certainly, as the firm has developed, we put a lot more resources into training, into development of our folks. And now we're having to contend with, you know, AI and the, you know, things like deep fakes.
Yes.
And I personally am a Luddite. I barely know how the toaster works, but I'm fortunate to have colleagues who, the woman who heads our digital investigations practice, Wendy Wu, mm-hmm. Is a lawyer, was a federal prosecutor in Los Angeles, and ran the cyber unit in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And then we have wonderful technical folks who understand this. We have a committee, an innovation committee that tracks technical changes and is looking at the role that AI can play in our investigations and the role that AI plays in fraud and in criminal activity. Mm-hmm. So it's something that we're very alive to. And I recognize the value of what these folks do.
Yes.
And I see the output of that. But I don't have a clue how they do it.
Okay.
It's just above my pay grade.
How do you feel about the changing role of investigations in the legal industry?
Well, I think it's actually positive because I think if you went back, 20, 30 years ago, maybe even longer, I think lawyers would use investigators for sort of smaller engagements, might not be concerned about, the ethics, might not be concerned about the level of professionalism as much. And I think today, lawyers certainly are clients, and we work with the best law firms in the U.S., the Magic Circle firms of Britain, I think are much more sophisticated in understanding the value that we can add. They also happily intolerant of people who don't do this work ethically and legally. And so in the best cases, we really work as partners with the law firm to help them support their legal theories by the fact finding that we do. So I think the industry, frankly, has become more sophisticated. And the understanding of what firms like mine do by the law firms and practitioners is more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about litigation and arbitration? How is the investigation process or even this tool that we're using important in those areas as well?
Well, as a good friend of mine likes to say, lawyers don't make cases, facts make cases. And so fact-finding, certainly in disputes, whether it's civil litigation, arbitration, international arbitration, white-collar criminal defense, the finding of facts that is going to be able to poke holes in your adversary's theory of the case and support your legal theory is crucial. And so whether that's getting material to impeach the adversary's witnesses or it's finding evidence, adducing evidence that supports your theory of the case, it is really integral to the prosecution or the defense of any dispute. And I would say a big chunk of our revenues comes from disputes. And that's exactly the sort of stuff that we're doing. We're looking to develop impeachment materials on the adversary's witnesses.
Yes.
We're looking to find facts that support our client's theory of the case.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really integral to litigation, certainly more complex litigation. And certainly where in those instances where discovery or disclosure, to the extent that it's available, and it'll mm-hmm. almost always be available in the U.S., not always elsewhere, to supplement and to inform discovery. That's where our work is also used.
What are some of the ways that attorneys, I know we mentioned ethically, but what are some of the other ways that attorneys can mitigate the risk of involving a private investigation firm in their practice?
Well, I think it's really know your investigator. And so what I would advise somebody to do is really have a chat with whoever they're engaging and cross-examine them a little bit. Some of the things you would ask is, how they handle conflicts. For instance, we treat, conflicts the way law firms do. Not every investigator firm does that. How do they maintain confidentiality?
Mm-hmm.
How do they culturally educate their folks on ethical and legal parameters? So I think the thing to do, one, is to have a frank conversation with whomever you're engaging. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is to do diligence on the folks that you're considering hiring, and, you know, whether taking a look in the media or looking to see if they've been sued. So if you find somebody who's been sued for misrepresenting themselves or for an invasion of privacy or something like that, you would exclude them, hopefully, from the possibility of a retention. So it's really doing due diligence on the people that you're partnering with. And you also have an obligation to do that to your client, to make sure that you're hiring professionals who are not going to cause harm.
Now, Nardello has represented some notable clients and been involved in some headline cases. Without sharing any attorney-client privilege, could you share some of your most notable cases? And I want to start with FTX.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about FTX because it's the fact of our engagement has been public. It's been the subject of congressional testimony. It was a, obviously, it was a big case. It garnered a lot of attention, and it was a chance, I'd like to think, to do our best work. We worked very closely with John Ray, who became the CEO of FTX, and his team, and the lawyers at Sullivan and Cromwell, terrific lawyers at Sullivan and Cromwell, and also on certain matters with the folks at Quinn Emanuel. You know, so we had the pleasure of dealing with a terrific, really smart, incredibly ethical client in John, and then working with really brilliant lawyers at Sullivan & Cromwell and Quinn. In that case, we did all sorts of things. We helped locate billions of dollars in assets. We looked to see who was the diligence of the people who were purchasing some of the FTX assets to make sure that the assets were not going to end up in the hands of problematic folks. And the case was really, all of our offices worked on it because the fraud and the collapse was really worldwide. So it was a very challenging but interesting and rewarding experience.
Now, I'm going to go back a little far, back into when you first started And I want to talk about the Pearl Jam case. Could you tell us a little bit of information about that one?
That is going back very far.
It is.
And this was in the public record. This related to a horrible tragedy at a concert in Roskilde and outside of Denmark. Where the band was playing a set, and during the course of the set, I think 10 or 11 kids were killed in a sort of crush on the stage. Just a terrible accident. The Danish police, I think irresponsibly, put out a statement saying that Pearl Jam was at least morally responsible for this, and that they weren't. And to make a long story very short, and it also has been a number of years, we were able to demonstrate to the police that not only was Pearl Jam not responsible for this, but they had taken measures at their concerts to prevent it. And it turned out that, if I recall correctly, the police were on notice of certain safety issues at the concert and really hadn't corrected them. It turned out to be quite a scandal in Denmark. The band were terrific people to work with. They were traumatized by what happened. And to the contrary of having any responsibility for it, they were appalled that it happened, and were instrumental in then showing the Danish police how they did crowd control at their concerts.
Now, something a little bit more recent is the Purdue Pharma case. Now, Nardella was selected by the Unsecured Creditors Committee of Purdue Pharma to trace back their global assets of the Sackler family. Could you tell us a little bit about your role in that case?
Well, I think you really described our role in that case. It was a terrific assignment. My partners, Howard Master and Nick Peck, are working on that. They're working with the team of wonderful lawyers at Akin Gump, who we got to know in another case that we've done that's public, in the Alex Jones bankruptcy, where we're also engaged by the Unsecured Creditors Committee. In that case, we're acting pro bono, because when I read about the Alex Jones case, the verdict and the position that he was taking vis-a-vis the families of these poor kids, I decided that we should help out, and we have. But essentially the same role in both cases is looking for assets of the debtor, investigating the debtor's income, assets, liabilities, ownership interest, potential assets. It's really all centered around the identification of assets to try and find money to satisfy the judgments.
What does that process look like, asset tracking?
Well, we do a lot of it, not just in the context of bankruptcies. Mm-hmm. My partner, Nick Peck, runs that practice, and he knows this better than I think anyone else around, having run the search for Iraqi assets and Saddam Hussein's assets after the first Gulf War. Mm. It's actually difficult investigative work, because you always have to calculate, or the client has to calculate, how much good money they want to throw after bad. The investigative methodology is pretty much the same. It's looking in open sources and then talking to folks. But you have to be creative. So we have found assets hanging in art museums, paintings, or oil tankers, or, you know, boats, real estate, all sorts of types of assets that could be monetized. And it's tough work, because there's always a calculus between, you know, using resource. Typically people have lost money. Or are expecting a judgment, or trying to evaluate whether it makes sense if there's a pot of gold at the litigation rainbow. So doing those cases in a way that's cost effective can be challenging. So you really have to have people who understand what they're doing, are focused, and are doing it in a, you know, a very thoughtful and cost effective way.
Now, I want to know, how are you cultivating those relationships? Because it seems that you said it earlier in the conversation that when you're talking to people, it's amazing how often they'll, you know, be forthcoming with you. But how do you cultivate those relationships so that you can continue getting that information from them, and they feel safe giving you that information?
Well, there are sort of two levels of people that we talk to. One that, again, we call confidential sources. And I kind of hate that, because it sounds like they're secret. There are folks that we may know in various industries, in law enforcement, in journalism, in diplomatic circles sometimes, who we have existing relationships with, maybe from another movie, and who we've come to know, and we respect their expertise, and we can talk to on a discrete basis. The more difficult group, and this is where some of my partners are just brilliant, is going out and talking to somebody you've never met before, who you believe, like a former employee who has information on the subject of the investigation. And so that work is led by Tom Feeney, a partner of mine who was at the U.S. Postal Inspector's Service, and worked very closely with the Southern District of New York on insider trading cases. And Tom and others here, like Chris Urban, former DEA, Joe Thompson, former DEA, they spent careers going out and talking to people and understanding how they, you know, what makes people tick and how to make the approach, and do it all while acting completely ethically and legally, not misrepresenting themselves, and establishing relationships. There's an art to that. You have to have a certain personality to connect with people and understand yes. where that connection exists. And mm-hmm. you also have to have the intellectual candle power to understand what the case is about and ask appropriate questions. Because we don't believe in a democracy of facts. If we're out in a case looking to impeach somebody's credibility, we're going to focus on facts that impeach their credibility, not extraneous facts that have nothing to do with what our objectives are in the case.
Mm. Now, with investigating and doing asset tracking and the other areas that you practice in, you also do a lot of vetting with different companies that hire you. Tell me more about that.
Well, we have a practice in vetting board candidates and C-suite candidates. The person who really runs that practice, although I know it's described as such, is my partner, Sabina Menschel. What we're doing there is looking for any reputational issues or legal issues that would reflect poorly on the candidate. Mm. And that's important also in the activist defense work that we do. And Sabina does a lot of that work as well, where we're looking potentially at an activist board slate to see if there are anything in the candidate's background and the people in that slate's background that is inconsistent with being on the board typically of a public company. We also do vetting in the sort of the context of anti-corruption or FCPA work. So we may be looking at somebody. A company wants to hire a defense contractor wants to hire an agent in Algeria, and they want to make sure that that person is not corrupt, is not a politically exposed person, doesn't run afoul of anything in the FCPA, and has a reputation for doing things the right way. So we do this in a number of different contexts.
Now, I know we spoke about some of the notable cases and the clients that you've represented and had a role in their case. But tell me, do you have a favorite or a most interesting one that has stuck with you over the years?
No. one of the nice things about this business is that over the years, as we do this work, I've made many, many friends. Mm. Clients have become friends, and I really enjoy that bit. So there are always cases where I'm working with my friends. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to say who they are because I don't want to leave anybody out. Those are the cases that to me are really the most rewarding.
Yes.
But you know, when I was a young prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office, there was a guy, who had been an investigator in that office. And before that, he had been a New York City police detective. And he was about 80, 82. And I said to him, his name was Carl Bogan. And I said to him, Carl, you know, why are you doing this? Why do you keep doing this? You have, you know, a lovely wife, you have grandchildren, you have children. Why are you still here? And mm-hmm. he said to me something I never forgot. It's really informed my career. He said, kid, every day's a free ticket to a show. And that's how I feel about what I do. We get involved in the most interesting things. The business is truly international and global. I work with wonderful people. I have wonderful clients. And so in any given day, I have a favorite case. But over the course of 22 years, I couldn't pick out one.
Mm. Now, when you first began Nardello, could you have ever imagined that it would be this grand and that you would be on this grand a scale in the UK, in the US?
Well, I'm not sure how grand it is, but I'm proud of what we built. I'm proud of the the people I work with. I think they're wonderful professionals, and I'm extraordinarily grateful to the clients who continue to put their faith in us. I'm not sure what I thought when I started this, I know I probably didn't expect that we'd have be all around the world and do the kind of work that we do. I'm very grateful.
Now, you've been given a couple of awards and recognitions. I won't say a couple, but a lot. And I stated at the beginning of our interview that you have been awarded the Global Investigations Review Investigations Consultancy of the Year. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and that was from GIR, and I think that was reflective mostly of the work that we did together with Sullivan Cromwell and Quinn Emanuel in FTX, and of course that was rewarding, and it's nice to be recognized, but and Chambers has been very, very good to us, The real recognition in this work is the fact that we have people who I like to call true loyals who engage us over and over again. And that's as satisfying really as anything else. It's nice to have sort of accolades, but the thing that keeps us afloat and keeps the work interesting is that our clients come back again and again. And that's really rewarding.
Are there any takeaways that you would like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, it's the way I start our CLE ethics presentation. A number of years ago, we were engaged by a terrific law firm in an asset search. And the partner was a terrific guy, great reputation, above reproach, said, we had another investigator firm on this. Take a look at the file. And so I looked at the file, and there was something in the file that indicated that the investigators that they hired had been obtaining bank account information, which is a felony.
Uh-huh.
And it clearly never got to this partner. Had they done some diligence on the investigator, it would have resulted in an article in the Village Voice. I don't know if you remember the Village Voice, but I'm old. I remember when it was a print publication.
Mm.
The title of which was Secret Agent Schmuck.
Mm.
What I like to say is don't hire a secret agent schmuck. Be careful who you do this business with and make sure it's being done the right way.
Fantastic. Well, Dan, I really enjoyed speaking to you, especially about your practice and all of the accolades are true. You've done great work.
Very
and
kind.
I'm grateful to have interviewed you today. So thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it.
The Hearing.
Thank you so much for listening today, and we are always welcoming feedback. If you have feedback or you have some topics that you'd like to hear, please send us an email at thehearing@tr.com.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.